CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal. Good morning, Montreal. You are tuned to the Wednesday Morning After on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. We have a good show for you today with one pre-recorded interview and two podcasts. The interview is with Georgia Lee Johnson. We'll listen to her music first on the show. The first podcast is In the Shower with Taz and Marcus. Why do we like roller coasters is the subject, done in the shower. And if you listen carefully in the background, you can hear the shower. The second podcast is a rabble podcast about why the union vote at Amazon lost. 8 o'clock brings Democracy Now!, 8:15 brings weather, and we'll wrap up the show. Let's start the day off with some music.
Personne qui se parle, sont stackés dans le métro, en retard dans leur routine, fixant dans le vide, ils se lèchent les babines. Tous et toutes trop fiers d'être des sardines. La ville en général. Ah non, y'a ben trop de gros buildings, pis de gros bonhommes drivés par l'argent sale. Trop de gens qui travaillent au salaire minimum, qui dépensent leur chèque dès qu'on leur donne pour rembourser la dette qu'on s'est créée. Tu cours après le temps. Jusqu'aux océans. aux océans. Thank you.
The alert level in your region or a neighboring region is red. To curb the spread of COVID-19, gatherings with family and friends in private homes and yards are prohibited. Travel between regions should be avoided, and traveling to yellow zones is forbidden. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. Visit quebec.ca/coronavirus to learn more about the other measures in place. Follow all the rules, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Georgia Lee Johnson sings with reverence and profound wisdom next to a sound that can only be described as mystic folk, featuring the traditional sounds of Appalachia, Irish, and African music. With us today, we have Georgia Lee Johnson. Hi, Georgia, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Sheila. Thank you so much for having me.
First, please introduce yourself and tell us how you came to be a singer.
All right. My name is Georgia Lee Johnson. That is my full name. And I'm privileged to live and work on the ancestral territories of the Squamish peoples in Squamish, BC. I grew up in Vancouver, and I lived in Ireland as a child. My journey towards being a singer started with a big passion for acting. I wanted to become an actress, and I moved to New York to study acting professionally. And I naturally express myself through my voice and through singing. Though when I was in theater school, I was comparing myself a lot to those extremely talented Broadway-bound singers and classically trained musicians. So I, at that point, put music aside, didn't consider myself really to be a singer. And then it was early in my 20s, after I'd finished university, that I reconnected with music through a few formative experiences. One of those being I participated in shooting a music documentary with a singer-songwriter named Josh Garrels, and his story and the way he independently forged his artistic path really inspired me, and he's a singer-songwriter. And the second formative experience was that I met this theater group who at the time were working with African American spiritual songs. And through singing and learning these songs, I reconnected with my own voice, and that propelled me back on a path towards singing. And I started writing my own songs.
Who are your bandmates and what do they play?
I have two core collaborators. So they are Jason Winnikoff and Winston Minkler. Jason plays drums and percussion, and his background with music is pretty eclectic. He studied jazz and improvisational music, and then he's also lived in New Orleans and Zambia studying traditional Haitian and Zambian music. And he's currently at UBC doing his PhD in traditional Luvale drumming. That's a people from Zambia. And I met him here in Vancouver. And then Winston plays upright bass, and he also studied jazz and plays in the jazz scene in Vancouver and gigs a lot with various bluegrass and folk musicians. He also has offered many times to jump on the electric bass, and we haven't found an opportunity for it yet in our songs. But so the core collaborators are Jason and Winston.
Your latest album is being released soon, called January Mind. What is the story behind this album?
So I wrote the songs on January Mind over 6 months during the fall and winter before the pandemic. So that would have been the end of 2019. And I had just moved back from Germany, where I was studying Waldorf education, and I went through a breakup, and I just wanted to intentionally take this pause in my life before deciding what to do next and dive deeper into my artistic practice. So my environment was very conducive to going inwards. I was living on an island. It was a very dark winter. And so I wanted to explore what darkness means inside of a person and inside of a society, and why we're afraid of darkness, and what gifts can come if you have the courage to look within those dark spaces. So I actually originally was writing it as a musical, funny enough, as a sort of pop-up living room folk fairy tale musical. And I had these little narrated pieces, and then sort of shaping it in this final version is that's when the pandemic hit and I realized, well, we're not going to be performing. So I scratched a lot of it and I just stuck with the core songs and turned my efforts towards production at that point.
May we hear some of your music?
Absolutely.
This is Lady Love on the Wednesday Morning After.
See?
Your latest release is called Open Ocean. What is the process you went through writing this song?
Open Ocean is a song which began, like a lot of my songs do, as a voice memo on my phone. I get ideas for songs when I'm out and about in the world, walking, driving. So I was commuting. I had a long drive on this internship several years ago, and I began recording on my phone this, just the little melody of the chorus. And at that point, I don't even think I had lyrics. And then what often happens with my songs is it stayed on my phone for a year. And it wasn't until I was writing what I thought was going to be a musical that I went back in my archives and listened to it again. And now I had already met and begun collaborating with Jason and Winston. So they brought these ideas of having this percussive soundscape. And I think at this point, I still didn't even have lyrics, but it already started putting the image of the open ocean. And where I was living on Main Island that winter was, I was on the open ocean. I had just gone through this breakup. And so it is a story which kind of narrates a lot of what I was going through at that time, just feeling like the inspiration that the natural setting was giving me was helping me to move forward in my life. And how would I say that to somebody else? So then I wrote the lyrics of the verses, and I actually went back and forth a lot with them, wanting the story to be really clear. And then when I had the guitar and vocal parts, then I brought it back to Jason and Winston. They jumped in the recording process. Jason, so he's the drummer and percussionist, he brought this whole map of the percussive elements and these interlocking rhythms that he wanted to make. And I think that really gave us the bones for the recorded version of this song.
What do you plan to do to celebrate this release?
Well, I wish we could tour and perform, but what we will do is I'd love to do a big live stream session when the whole album is out, probably over Zoom. And when it's safe, I'd love that we can perform outside. I do have plans to print the record on vinyl, and I've completed the artwork and I'm really excited about it. But ultimately, even if we have to wait many more months, my ultimate dream to celebrate it is with people in person in a safe setting. So likely that would be outdoors when that's permitted.
May we hear some more of your music?
All right.
This is Open Ocean on CKUT.
Thank you.
describe all the glory you will surely find. On the open ocean awaits for you.
If our listeners want some free listening time or to buy your music, where should they go?
So free listening, Open Ocean is online, all the major streaming platforms. So Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube. The best way to support artists is through Bandcamp, bandcamp.com. You can look up Georgia Lee Johnson. The links to all of these pages are on my social media accounts. I have Facebook and Instagram. And I do want to let listeners know that Bandcamp does this really awesome thing called Bandcamp Friday. That's the first Friday of every month, and all of the proceeds goes directly to the artist. So the platform's not taking off any fees on just the first Friday of every month. So if you do plan to purchase, then I would recommend Bandcamp Friday.
Thank you for your interview today.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Georgia Lee Johnson speaking about her latest releases. I am your host, Sheila Ferrando.
Early in the morning, before the sun rose, when the first bird sang, even while everyone was still asleep.
Morning. On that morning when the sun comes out.
This morning, baby.
Cock-a-doodle-doo. I hear the rooster crowing.
Now you must wake up.
Not every morning when I wake up.
I woke up this morning with
the kiss of the morning.
Got up 7:30 every morning for the same breakfast.
Réveillez-moi à 8 heures demain matin.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Riding a bike made of bacon and eggs.
In the morning.
In the morning.
In the morning.
Why should the sun replace the moonlight?
Has this ever happened to any of you, or will it happen to any of you, on the morning after the night before?
You are listening to The Morning After on CKUT 90.3 on the FM dial.
Have you ever been on a terrifying theme park ride, about to plummet over the edge and thought, why the hell am I doing this? Well, strap in as we look at why humans love roller coasters.
In the shower with Taz and Marcus, 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 in the shower with Taz and Marcus.
Hello, beautiful listener, and welcome to In the Shower with Taz and Marcus, a bite-sized, informative podcast that answers the mysteries of the world in 15 or so minutes.
Have you ever wondered if plants have feelings?
Or why most black cats have a white spot?
Or how much wood a woodchuck would actually chuck if it could indeed chuck wood?
If you've wondered the answer to any of those questions, then good news, you've come to the right place. We've answered those, and we're about to answer one more.
So step into the cubicle with us as we answer, why do humans love roller coasters?
In the shower with Taz and Marcus, 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 in the shower with Taz and Marcus.
This week's question comes from Bavin Whelan, and she's asked us why people like roller coasters. Good question.
Bavin is a fantastic listener. She gets in contact with us often.
Mm-hmm.
I believe she's studying abroad, is she?
She is...
Did she say she was studying some sort of physics?
Yeah, she's studying astrophysics.
Astrophysics abroad. So, Bavin, thank you so much for sending in the question and for being an amazing listener. We really, really, really appreciate you, and we hope that you enjoy this episode.
Okay, so, yeah, she's asked us why people like roller coasters.
It's an absolutely fair question. Like, roller coasters scare the living Jesus out of me, and Marcus absolutely loves them.
They genuinely do, right? I've always... always, always loved roller coasters. Ever since I was like tall enough to get onto them. I remember like begging my parents to let me to go onto roller coasters as a kid, right? And I love the feeling. But Taz, on the other hand, we went to Disneyland a few years ago for Taz's birthday, and she was terrified of everything. She was scared of the teacups.
Wait. Okay, Disneyland was sold to me, you know. Disney characters, Minnie Mouses, everything in the shape of Mickey Mouse. Mickey Mouse lollipops, Mickey Mouse pancakes, loads of fun and friendship, running, frolicking around, getting Minnie Mouse ears. And next thing you know, I'm on this mad roller coaster going through space, what it would seem like. And it was scary, Marcus. It was scary.
Yeah, but the teacups aren't scary.
The teacups, you know, they go relatively fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And?
Okay, but in all honesty, I did love the teacups. Come
yeah.
on.
Yeah, to be fair.
I just don't know if I like the fear and anticipation of it. Like, in the 10 seconds before it goes off, that's when I'm like, oh no, what did I do?
What you said just there kind of leads perfectly into the reason why we all love a bit of a thrill.
Fear and anticipation. What could be fun about that?
So, fear isn't always a bad thing when you think about it, right?
The only thing to fear is fear itself.
And roller coasters.
Yes, this
there
is true.
There you go. but like, no, obviously fear, we associate that with danger, but fear is the body's response to perceived danger, right?
Okay.
And generally triggers the release of a whole cascade of chemicals which prepares you to either run or face the danger.
So sort of like fight or flight, which we've talked about a few times in this podcast.
That's exactly it, fight or flight. Which, do you know what, actually, I've talked about this before, but if this is your first time listening to In the Shower, I used to keep chickens in the city centre of Dublin. They eventually got consumed by a fox.
Rest in peace, Marcus is shedding a tear.
But one of the things that's actually really interesting is, like, chickens have a third option. They're the only animal I know of that have a third option of fight or flight, which is just to die. Like, sometimes chickens will be in a dangerous situation and they will just die. Seriously. But what upsets me about that whole thing is that they're birds. They have the options of both fight and flight, but they just choose to die. But anyway, fight or flight, basically, yeah, in terrifying, dangerous situations, your body prepares for extreme response by kicking in a load of brain chemicals, which can make you have more energy, not feel as much pain, and it can actually shut down things like critical thinking, basically to just survive. But when you take survival out of the equation...
To be honest, feeling highly energised and pain-free sounds pretty fantastic to me.
I mean, can you imagine? Like, loads of energy, no pain, and zero critical thinking. It basically turns you into a toddler again. And who doesn't want that, right? The chemicals that are released are basically like a superdose of the same ones that you feel when you're happy or excited or in other highly arousing situations, if you know what I mean.
So what exactly is the difference between the fear you feel on a roller coaster and the fear you feel when you're like facing down a bear fighting for your life?
I wonder if how many people actually like fight bears every year. But anyway, the all
but
important
it lasts.
Yeah, that's for another episode. The all important difference here lies in the context in which you're feeling the fear, right? If there's a bear in front of you, then yeah, you're going to get all of those hormones and adrenaline, but you're also going to be fighting a bear trying to survive. So, you know, not great. But if you've just strapped into like Thunder Mountain Express in a theme park, that element of real danger is slightly pushed to one side, and we can just enjoy the natural high that getting out of your comfort zone provides.
So basically, roller coasters make you high.
In a very basic sense. A controlled sense of danger in a safe space gives us all the thrill of a dangerous situation with none of the actual danger. But there's more to it than that. Getting through to the end of a terrifying experience can give you a great boost of self-esteem.
Interesting.
Similar to achieving any kind of challenges that you set for yourself, except in this case, the perceived challenge is just survival.
Wow,
you come
that's
out of it
really
and you're just
interesting.
Like, I did it, I survived. Like, I remember in Disneyland, I forced you onto Space Mountain. You were like, no, 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 no. And by the end of it, you felt great.
That is such, that is on it. Like, that is really, really interesting because there's so many experiences, even, you know, like even getting into the really cold sea where you're, even my mind is already jumping to what happens when I get out. Like, I'm going to feel so much better after I do it. That's exactly. so interesting. So basically, humans love roller coasters because it's doing something terrifying in essentially a safe context. And that makes all the difference. But there's no real threat of injury or death. So we...
Yeah, you still get the same rush out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, but when you actually think about it, like shark diving, haunted houses, like all of those things, like even stuff like adrenaline sports, scuba diving, base jumping, so many of those kind of trade on that slightly less dangerous sense of danger.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That's
living life on the edge, man.
As a final thing, fear brings us together. Generally, when you think about it, we get on roller coasters with people we love. We get on roller coasters with friends, with family. We get a photo of it in the end. And coming through a fearful experience can bond people at a really primal level.
This is Marcus selling Space Mountain to me again.
Do you want to go again?
Please.
All right. So yeah, that's basically why humans love roller coasters.
That's very, very interesting. Any sort of roller coaster fear, fun, flight facts to end the episode?
I've got two, right? Do you want to go with a fact about fear or a fact about roller coasters?
Fear.
Okay, starting with fear. Have you ever heard of Australia? Of course you've heard of Australia. So,
what is this Australia thing? Yeah.
So there's a jellyfish that's kind of terrifyingly common off the coast of Australia.
Okay.
Called the Irukandji jellyfish.
Wow.
Right?
Yep.
And if it stings you, it can cause something called Irukandji syndrome.
Wow, it has its own syndrome.
It has its own syndrome. And one of the... So it has all of the usual things that can be associated with box jellyfish stings, which can be, you know, cardiac arrest, death, spasm. But the unique thing about Irukandji syndrome is that it can give anyone who's stung a sense of extreme fear or impending doom.
Oh, God, that's horrific.
Do you want to hear the even more scary thing?
Yeah.
It's about the size of a peanut and almost invisible in daylight.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Jesus Christ, Australia, that's terrifying.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Right.
Glad we went with that one first. Okay, roller coaster fact.
Okay, right. This one's actually pretty cool. And this one spoke to me, right? So I'm half French. And going on roller coasters. And going on roller coasters. Okay. But you know what the word for roller coasters is in French?
What?
Montagne russe, which means Russian mountains.
Ah.
So this
Montagne
is
russe.
Montagne russe.
Montagne russe.
Which, like, I always looked at roller coasters so like, listen, these are neither mountains or Russian, like France. What are you up to? But this is the crazy thing. If all countries were as cold as Russia, roller coasters might not exist, right? So in the 17th century, Russians used to freeze water over a tall wooden structure to make an ice ramp to which riders would sit on blocks of wood stuffed with straw and slide down the ramp.
Amazing.
Apparently, Paris wanted to join in the fun but realised it was impossible because of the warmer climate that's found in France. However, they got around that by adding wheels to the sledges that they would have used in winter to use a track for the ride around 1817, creating the first modern roller coaster.
Wow!
There you have it.
In the show with Tazimarcus, 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 in the show with Tazimarcus.
So there you have it, Bevan.
Thank you so much for sending in that question and for sending in a few questions, actually.
Mm-hmm. And sending in a picture of a dog as well, which
is always, we always appreciate.
Always big bonus points for that. But that was a really fun episode to research. I really want to go on a roller coaster now.
Even I do.
Absolutely.
But everyone else, thank you so much for listening to this episode of In the Shower with Taz and Marcus. We appreciate you dedicating your ears to us for the last 15 or so minutes. If you are like Bevan and have a question that you would like us to research and answer and give you all of our findings in a bite-sized little chunk, then you can do so.
It's very easy. If you want to get in touch with us with a question or a dog picture or just to say hello or anything like that, you can get us on Facebook. Just look up In the Shower with Taz and Marcus, or Instagram. Just search In the Shower Pod. Same with Twitter.
If you want to send a question or a message or just a hello to our email address, it's intheshowerpodcast@gmail.com.
If you like what we're doing, please tell your friends, tell your podcast buddies, tell your granny, tell your colleagues. That would be really cool.
Believe it or not, that's how podcasts spread. It's through word of mouth. So if you just tell one other person that you enjoyed this, that would mean an awful lot to me and my little ginger friend Marcus over there.
That's me.
Next week's episode.
Next week's episode is a really good one. It's infectious. It's an earworm.
It's an earworm, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Next week's episode of In the Shower, Taz and Marcus asks, why do songs get stuck in our head?
That episode's going to be ready in time for your morning shower next Monday. But in the meantime, keep scrubbing.
In the shower with Taz and Marcus, 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 in the shower with Taz and Marcus.
This has been a production of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's radio. Free radio.
This is Solidarity News on Radio Labour.
This is a Radio Labour Canada report recorded on Friday, April 16th, 2021. I'm Marc Boulanger. In the report this week, the Amazon union vote that was lost in Alabama and its implications for Canada. How cities are taking back privatized services. The Labour Start report about union events and rapping.
Yo, I've been hearing a lot of trash talk about unions, saying these ain't the friends to be choosing, out for themselves, not for others.
This is Radio Labour. In early April, workers at an Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, in the United States, voted against joining a union. The Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union, the RWDSU, had high hopes that the workers would be able to withstand the powerful anti-union tactics of the company. But that was not to be. To find out more about anti-union strategies in the United States, I talked to Richard Bensinger. Mr. Bensinger is a former national organizing director of the AFL-CIO in the U.S. He currently helps labor organizations such as the Workers United Canada Council with their organizing drives. I asked him to describe the sort of tactics companies use to stop their employees from unionizing.
The goal of a corporation like Amazon is to prevent at any cost, their workers from having a voice in the job, having a union and any power. In order to achieve that, they have a whole arsenal of weapons at Amazon and other employers. Employers typically threaten workers to try to get them to go their way. Or if that doesn't work, they can promote people out of the bargaining unit. I remember a zillion years ago, when I worked in my factory, I was offered a management job suddenly to get me out of the unit. And when that didn't work, they said, well, I'll be looking over. Is it Mr. Bensinger? You'll be looking over your shoulder every day the rest of your life. And when I finally was fired, it took me 6 years to win my job back, long after the union election was over. So, you know, the same thing as this today. You smear the union, you take people in one-on-one. But the main thing that Amazon did and employers do is they totally 100% under current laws, dominate the process. And the breadth and the sort of 24 nature pressure campaign of putting stress and fright and intimidating people 24/7, that has a toll on people. And when the richest guy on earth, the overlord of society, Jeff Bezos, tells you he really doesn't want you to vote somewhere, that's just not somebody else's opinion. He makes it very clear through his fanaticism. Every second you're working in there leading up to the election, it's a domination of a process. It doesn't look like an election you would run in Canada, United States for a, you know, if you're running for the, you know, a political office, electoral office. There's no equal time in these elections, and the employer can simply dominate. They can run mandatory meetings and cult the places both know. They can make implied threats. They can fire union leaders. And even if you win your job back, like I was saying earlier, it could be months, years later that you get your job back. So it's a total control of the workplace. It's certainly unprincipled, but that's what they do. I mean, I had a campaign in Canada at Lush Cosmetics this last fall, where it's the worst campaign I've seen in Canada, where Lush, you know, Lush did virtue signals. It's pro-union rights and pro-worker rights. And you think if you look at Lush's website, they're just a progressive organization, but it's all in pro-environmental and social justice, environmental justice. But these companies like Lush and Amazon, they virtue signal, but when it comes, you know, all they're good. But when it comes to actually respecting their own employees' right to have a voice in the job, they wage war against them. And in case of Lush or Amazon or other people, it's a win-at-any-cost attitude.
There is legislation being considered in the U.S. Congress called the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, known as the PRO Act. Tell us about this proposed legislation.
Well, the PRO Act is a sweeping labor law reform agenda that would, you know, give more power to workers that want to organize unions. What it is, it has a lot of provisions, but some of the most important ones are it would eliminate so-called right to work or right to work for less laws, where the union has to represent everybody, but not everyone has to be a member. It's just designed to weaken unions. It would impose much stricter penalties when employers do break the law, and the right of private action by individuals to sue companies, much more stiff fines for firings and breaking U.S. labor law. It would abolish the right of a company like Amazon to have mandatory, what we call captive audience meetings, where they can force people to come in and listen. And even more effective are all the one-on-one meetings that Amazon does, where they just bend people's arm. They can be friendly. They can be threatening. You know, and all this is legal under the current, you know, their implicit threats are allowed under laws in both Canada and the United States. And so, but under the PRO Act, you wouldn't be allowed to have these meetings. And it would really create a more level playing field, because there's no other election in society where one side can order people to come in. If you don't come to the meeting, they can fire you because you're refusing to come to the meeting. The other things they would establish, things like first contract arbitration, it would make it so that independent contractors can bargain, something the Ontario Labor Relations Board has ruled on already with the Fedora, which is a good ruling, saying that these are dependent contractors and they're covered by the Ontario Labor Relations Act and they can organize a union. But in the States, there's been a lot of attempt by the rideshare industry and Instacart and other people lobbying heavily to exclude millions of gig workers.
For years now, governments have been privatizing public services in vain attempts at saving money. But that may be changing. C. Marie Ainsborough reports.
As the pandemic continues to put pressure on governments to provide safe and secure public services, unions are pushing for a reversal of the privatization of many services. And there are indications that governments are paying attention. For example, many cities are remunicipalizing, or as it's called, insourcing, privatized water systems. The topic was discussed in a recent webinar. Daria Cibrario is the policy officer for local and regional government issues for Public Services International. The PSI is the Global Union Federation for Public Service Unions.
There are fights to reclaim services around the world. The first case I want to flag up is Canada, where long-term care homes have recorded the highest rate of deaths among residents and staff worldwide. And just by accident, it happens that these care homes are majority owned by a private company called Revera. And this company, on top of that, practices aggressive tax avoidance and uses offshore subsidiaries in tax havens. And now our affiliate in Canada, which is CUPE, the Canadian Union of Public Employees, is teaming up with other social movements, but is by itself reclaiming and insourcing of these essential services under public control. And there are two-thirds of the Canadian people who are in favor of bringing back in-house this essential service. There's also, obviously, obviously a demand that health is no longer run for profit. And we've seen how the systematic privatization, outsourcing and defunding of many services, including in countries which have traditionally very strong public health care systems, such as the NHS in the UK, but also in France, have performed badly because of this situation. So there's a demand to bring back, to insource services so that our public health care systems can be strong again and thrive and deliver the superior health options they need to deliver. If we want to consolidate our increasingly stronger counter narrative, which is to neutralize the pro liberalization and pro privatization dominant narrative, we also need to build collectively evidence of viable public funding solutions, especially for local public services. Because right now, what is happening is that in the pandemic, the local councils are under pressure. Some are already in bankruptcy, especially in the UK, in Canada, in the US, but everywhere in the world where cities and local governments are run increasingly as companies.
You can find more information about the PSI's campaign to insource privatized public services at publicservices.international. This is Seymourie Ainsborough reporting for Radio Labour.
Here with his report about union events is Labour Start correspondent Derek Blackadder.
Some of the big stories on our Canadian news pages this week included the first in what looks to be a series of warning strikes by Quebec public sector workers, as most of the province's francophone teachers were off the job on Wednesday. Time-limited warning strikes like this week's one-day walkout are a common tactic in Quebec and one or two other provinces. This is one of those ideas that should catch on, but never seems to. We also covered the union reaction to news of a bailout for Air Canada. CUPE, which represents the airline's flight attendants, could see benefits only for the company's shareholders and nothing for its members or for the taxpayers who will be providing the cash. Another of our top stories involved CUPE is that union moved to support the unions and workers striking in an effort to reverse the military coup in Myanmar. And lastly, but not leastly, we carried an expose from the Public Services International, that's the Global Union Federation for Public Sector Workers, that lays out the linkages between the Canada Pension Plan and funding for the privatization of Brazil's water systems. Yet another case of a bad idea rightly getting the boot from the global north, but having a very, very profitable second life somewhere in the global south, where profits trump people in the minds of far-right politicians like Brazil's Bolsonaro. Canadian labor history items on our site for this week included the death in 1903 of British Columbia union organizer Frank Rogers. A longshoreman, he was shot while supporting clerical workers on strike against the Canadian Pacific Railway in Vancouver. And the 1872 turnout in Toronto, when a massive crowd of 10,000 people marched to the Ontario legislature in support of the printer's strike for the nine-hour day. Finally, we mark the 1972 strike by 200,000 public sector workers in Quebec that resulted in the arrest of union leaders and a victory for the strikers. Check our Quebec news page for news of how things are going in the current round of bargaining. Not well, if Wednesday's warning strike by 75,000 teachers is anything to go by. CanCon on our Global Health and Safety Newswire included coverage of the conditions endured by migrant workers in Quebec who have been quarantined for almost a month. The Mexican seafood processing plant workers face a new 14-day period of isolation each time they are exposed to COVID-19, plus some are still waiting for the results of the tests they took on arrival in Canada. Those results are late, and pending their arrival, the workers remain in isolation and unemployed. Current campaigns that we are running at the request of unions around the world include an urgent appeal for online solidarity with workers in Pakistan who are facing a well-planned and concerted union-busting campaign by a transnational wholesaler. Look for details of this and other campaigns on our site. This is Derek Blackadder from Labor Start, reporting for Radio Labor.
Now here is Luke Rodriguez with Solidarity Forever.
Yo, I've been hearing a lot of trash talk about unions, saying these ain't the friends to be choosing, out for themselves, not for others. You might have heard unions ain't good for your health, brother. Well, let me spit it for you, got something to say. It's because of unions, we got an 8-hour workday. This ain't no commercial break, my friend. Unions are the peeps who brought you the weekend. Probably never think about it, la-di-da-di. Unions fought hard for your right to party. They're out there to ease your tension with decent wages, health care, and pensions. Now it's like unions blamed for bad weather. But tell me what's wrong with Solidarity Forever. I want to shout it on high, get it off my chest. The story here is fighting for those who have less. So when unions are bad guys in the propaganda war, think what they've done, where they stand, who they fight for.
And that's it, labor news you can use. You can find our international features and daily newscasts at radiolabor.net. Follow us on Twitter at Radio Labor. I'm Mark Boulanger. Thank you for listening. And remember, it's all about solidarity.
The global outbreak of COVID-19 has affected all our lives in various ways, and it has notably drawn our attention to the intensified systemic racism and selective xenophobia towards our racialized friends in our Canadian society. It is understandable for each of us to feel anxious about this fatal disease. However, the sentiment of fear does not give us the right or the opportunity to conduct hate crime and to discriminate against our Asians, Blacks, Indigenous, and other racialized friends. It is not okay to associate the COVID-19 disease with Asians, particularly those of Chinese descent. It is not okay to conduct physical and psychological abuses towards racialized individuals. It is not okay to vandalize Asians and other marginalized owned businesses. We must stop normalizing and stop accepting racist conducts and hate speeches towards all racialized communities. Rather, in these unprecedented times of global pandemic, together, we must educate ourselves and others and be eager to understand race, systemic racism, and racial justice in Canada and elsewhere. Remember, whoever, wherever, and whenever we are humankind. We must learn to stand together as citizens of the world for a healthier, safer, and happier community.
You're listening to the Wednesday Morning After Show with your host, Sheila Ferrando, on CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal, or worldwide at ckut.ca.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Jury deliberations have begun in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer charged with murder and manslaughter for killing George Floyd by kneeling on his neck for over 9 minutes last May. On Monday, jurors heard closing arguments in one of the most closely watched criminal trials in years. This is prosecutor Steve Schleicher.
You can believe your eyes. It's exactly what you believed. It's exactly what you saw with your eyes. It's exactly what you knew. It's what you felt in your gut. It's what you now know in your heart. This wasn't policing. This was murder.
Judge Peter Cahill gave final instructions to 12 jurors who will remain sequestered at a hotel during their deliberations. Thousands of students from dozens of Minnesota schools walked out of classes Monday, demanding justice for George Floyd and for Dante Wright, the 20-year-old Black man shot dead by a white police officer during a traffic stop in the Minneapolis suburb of Brooklyn Center April 11th. The city's mayor, Mike Elliott, a Black man who's born in Liberia, told CNN Monday, "It's not safe to drive in Minnesota while you're Black."
And if we see police behind us, we're afraid, you know, we're trembling. And that is a kind of terror that no citizen of the United States should ever have to face. It's constant. It's ever present.
Ahead of the verdict,